sense that what the church should be is, rather than an institution, should be a servant to those in need. And there were a lot of comments about how we live in a culture that's very materialistic, it's very consumerist, where there's a lot of exploitation of people around the world and of the creation that we're a part of. And a number of people were saying that really the role of the church should be as a countercultural institution. If the culture is materialistic and consumerist, then what we should have is a counterculture in the church. The problem is that, or one of the other comments was that what the church should be is, it should be identifying itself with and listening to the poor, the oppressed, the minorities. But one of the problems in listening to the poor and the homeless, the jobless, is they often don't have a voice. In this society, they're outcasts, and they're often fairly invisible to us. Occasionally, they're objects to be talked about, but very rarely do they have their own voice. For example, you don't see a lot of TV shows that are hosted by homeless people or jobless people who have their own newspaper. One of the problems with our media is that it excludes certain kinds of people. Today, what I want to do is play you a radio piece called Zoom Black Magic, which was actually a program on NPR, part of All Things Considered, about a year and a half ago, which is about a black radio station. It's a program in a program then. We'll be hearing the actual black radio station, but within a kind of a radio documentary form. But first, I just want to make a couple of comments. One of the things about television and radio and newspapers in America is that for the most part, it's a white male middle class phenomenon. If you think about TV, for example, women in TV typically are ornaments. Okay, if we have a news show and we hear experts, most of the experts are likely to be males. Studies of Nightline, for example, have shown that something like 80 or 90% of all the people on there are white males. Similarly, if we look at most entertainment shows, most of the heroes tend to be males. Now, there are clearly some exceptions. Murphy Brown is one. We can think back to Cagney and Lacey and some others. But typically, it's the male that has the lead role and the woman that's the supporting role, that's either the helpmeet or the sex object or whatever. Well, this shouldn't be too strange in a society where white males occupy most positions of power and wealth. What the media tends to do is reinforce a system and reinforce a system that it is profiting from. And if we think about the companies that bring us these programs, typically they're large media conglomerates. And one of the trends over the last few years, particularly in the Reagan administration, with its saying, well, we're not going to have any more antitrust actions, is that this tendency towards bigger and bigger media conglomerates has increased, and now it's not just within the United States, but you have these multinational things. Sony bought up Columbia Pictures, Matsushita, which most of us don't know, but we know Panasonic, which is just one of the brands that Matsushita makes, bought up Universal Pictures. We have the merger of Time, the Time Life company, with Warner Brothers Pictures. NBC is owned by General Electric, which, as some of you may know, is one of the largest suppliers of nuclear energy and nuclear weapons in the country, which is bound to influence some of the news reporting we get from NBC. Okay, my point is that unless you own or control media in this country, you don't have much of a voice in it. Someone has once said that we have freedom of the press in this country only if you own one. Okay, so as frequently the perspectives and views of the world that we get are not those of minorities, are not those of women, are not those of dissidents. Now, we now have cable television, which promises a lot more diversity, but one of the things, the more you watch cable, the more you realize that all it is there's more of the same stuff. So you now get, you know, TNT, which gives you movies all the time, except when it gives you sporting events. Or you get ESPN, which gives you sporting events all the time. Or Discovery, which kind of gives you certain PBS programs all the time. There is a lot more of religion on cable, but if you flip from one religious station to the next, you see they're all fundamentalist Christian religions. We don't have like a Buddhist channel or a Lutheran channel or other things like that. They all tend to be similar sorts of programs. It's a fairly narrow range of program types. Okay, I'm going to play the thing now, the piece from about Zoom Black Magic, and in some ways this may be hard to listen to in parts. I think other parts are very interesting, but there may be parts that make us uncomfortable. And I would like you to pay attention to which parts do make you uncomfortable so we can talk about that and talk about why they might make us uncomfortable. I want you to also look at ways in which this kind of program this kind of station provides a resistance to kind of the dominant culture or an alternative to that, and look for ways in which this program represents or encourages or helps build an alternative community to the one that we're being pushed towards, or to the fake community that we all have with through the normal broadcasting media. Okay, let's listen to this without ado.
Where did this program come from?
This was broadcast on a National Public Radio's Weekend All Things Considered, which...
But is it from a specific state?
It's about a radio station in Springfield, Illinois.
Oh, okay.
Okay? And this kind of gets explained as it goes.
If you're ever driving through Springfield, Illinois, and scan up and down the radio dial, it won't sound much different than radio in any medium-sized city. There are the light rock stations, the religious stations,
and I'm thankful for what happened to me. Glory to God.
The homogenized mix of news, weather, and commercials that make the FM band one of the soothing constants in American life. Except in Springfield, for one station, which only broadcasts during certain hours, can only be picked up in certain parts of town, has no license, and is a continuing irritant to government officials. NPR's Gary Gavino visited the station recently. He has this report.
On the mostly black, mostly poor east side of Springfield, just a few blocks from the house where Abraham Lincoln lived before he became president, is the John Hay Homes Housing Project. Row upon row of squat, two-story apartment buildings. Drab, run-down, red brick dwellings built in the late 1930s. Tourists visiting the Lincoln Shrines never see this area, where the average income is less than $5,000 a year, and three-quarters of the adult males are unemployed. Ibana Kantako grew up in the John Hay Homes. He lives with his wife and their three children in an apartment in the middle of the project, in a building indistinguishable from all the rest, except if you look closely for an extra-large antenna up on the roof, And inside, in the corner of this small living room, were the jumble of wires and boxes that make up Kantanko's radio station.
Well, basically, you start at the top shelf, and we, on the far left there, we have the transmitter and the stereo compressor stacked on top of each other. And they're no bigger than a toaster. To the right of that, we have a disco mixer, which is where all the sounds that we want to go on the air first go. And then on the second shelf, we have two cassette decks, JVC.
How much power does your station put out?
0.4 watts.
0.4 of 1 watt.
There you go, yeah.
That's less than the nightlight, isn't it?
It's less than the garage door opener.
But it's enough. Enough to carry the signal a mile and a half out from Kantanko's living room. He can reach every radio in the John Hay homes, and because of Springfield's largely segregated housing patterns, most of the radios in the black parts of town. Kantanko's station is illegal. He has no license. He never bothered to apply for one. It cost him about $600 to construct the station, which first went on the air in 1986 as WTRA, a project of the John Hay Homes Tenants' Rights Association. Last year, the Federal Communications Commission, the Springfield Police Department, and the Springfield Housing Authority all tried to shut the station down. Since then, Kantanko's ignored the FCC and continued the type of inflammatory broadcasting which got him in trouble in the first place. He's even dropped the WTRA call letters. Call letters are for sellout license stations, he says. And he's come up with something more baroque, Zoom Black Magic Liberation Radio. On a recent weekday night at 9 p.m., Kantanko flipped on the transmitter and reoccupied his unauthorized frequency, starting with a tape he and his wife Brenda produced on their telephone answering machine.
Liberation Radio Control, this is Zoom Black Magic, looking for clearance to zoom to the souls of the black community.
Zoom Black Magic, this is Liberation Radio Control. You'll be taking off on 107.1.
Zoom Black Magic, number Roger.
For the next 5 hours, Kantanko will use his makeshift equipment to beam out a steady stream of rap and reggae music, listener phone calls, political commentaries, and excerpts from talking books for the blind. Kantanko is almost completely blind himself. A big man, wearing dark glasses, a black beret, and a Malcolm X t-shirt, he sits in a clunky old metal office chair, hunched over his tape decks, relying on his ears, his fingers, and what little sight he has to find the right cassettes and push the right buttons. While the first song plays, he leans back to give his white guest a lesson in the language he and his listeners speak.
Behavior dictates how we characterize different things. In terms of the white race, there's two groups of whites. There's the fellow travelers, as those who are conscious enough to understand the exploitive nature of capitalism. And then there's cave boys who seek to benefit off the exploitive nature of capitalism. And they refer to blacks as house niggas and field hands. Or sometimes we call the house niggas Afro-Saxons, okay? The police, we refer to them as the pigs. This is their behavior. This is where they behave, just like, you know, scroungy, dirty pigs. Sometimes we call them cave pigs, you know. They really get mad at them.
There are other terms, which I learn as the night goes on. The arrest of any black person in the projects is a kidnapping. The police are the occupying army. When they move in to make drug arrests, it's an invasion. The drug traffic itself, though, is a cave boys operation, designed to suck the money and the life out of the black community.
People's Choice, Zoom Black Magic. We are in our 366th consecutive night of broadcasting. How you doing? Ben and Kantanko, which are going to take you into Friday morning. Locally, I'll just deal with some state things. So did you hear that the Fraternal Order of Pigs has come out to endorse Roland Burris? Guess you know whose side Roland Burris is on, don't you?
Roland Burris is a black man.
Listen to the People's Choice, one day into our second year of consecutive nights of broadcasting. Tell you what, the lies never quit.
I'm living like hell in a world of protectors of the people.
until a few months ago, Mbana Kantanka went by his given name, what he calls his slave name, Duane Reedus. Now, one group he is trying to reach with Zoom Black Magic Radio are the young people of his community, especially the ones committing crimes, the ones selling or using drugs, the ones doing now what Duane Reedus did when he was young.
Drink. I used to mess with drugs. I used to ride with the pimps. I just did anything that the average black guy would do in the ghetto, you know, anything. I mean, there's nothing I didn't do. This was crazy as hell.
Until one Saturday night, many years ago, a drunken argument with a friend at a party turned into a fist fight, then a brawl. Someone called the police, who arrived to mete out their own brand of rough justice.
The beating, they just really almost killed me, really. I don't think if I wouldn't have been in good shape, I think I might have been killed, because they just literally just beat the living hell out of me.
Until the beating, Kantanko's eyesight had been weak, but manageable. He could do almost everything without much trouble except drive a car. But after the beating, he suffered from spells of severely blurred vision, which got worse and worse until, at times, he could see nothing but light. It was, he says, like being locked in prison.
I couldn't just up and go where I wanted to go because there was no telling when this blurred vision would pop in, and I would be trapped wherever I was until it came back. And sometimes it might take 5 minutes, sometimes it'd take hours, you know. So it just gave me time to like reflect on things. And I looked at it on the inside of me and I didn't like what I saw, you know. And just kind of like got myself together a little better. I started paying attention to my conscience.
When he could function again, Kantanko became a community activist. He joined the Tenants' Rights Association, which was fighting for better conditions in the John Hay homes. He helped establish a children's library. And with a friend who knew something about electronics, he put WTRA on the air.
4-10-4.
Probably the most expensive piece of equipment in Kantanko's living room, and the one that's never turned off, is the police scanner, a receiver that picks up the squad cars and the dispatchers of the Springfield Police Department. Kantanko often puts his microphone up to the scanner and lets his listeners hear what the police are saying. Kantanko has been monitoring the police for so long, he knows all their codes and can read their moods.
86
Sergeant's office. They just told 1P to come by the office and see a sergeant. He don't sound too happy about it, so he must have did something they didn't like too much. Yeah, he just told that pig to give him a call, and he was on his way to the hospital. He taking somebody to jail, but they had to take him by the hospital first, so those two, 86 and 58, must have did something to that person, and somebody must have called the station about it.
The relationship between the poor black community in Springfield and the police department is a tense one. Black residents complain about being harassed on the street, roughed up, sometimes even shaken down for their money. But a move to establish an independent review commission to investigate complaints against the police was defeated by Springfield's overwhelmingly white city council. The vote on the review commission came after a series of violent incidents last year, which included beatings, the death of a prisoner in the city jail, and controversial large-scale drug raids. All of these were broadcast back to the community on Zoom Black Magic Radio. Victims of police violence visited Kantanko's living room and told their stories over the air, often, in their outrage, lacing them with obscenities. And when they couldn't come to him, Kantanko took his cheap, beat-up tape recorder to them.
We're in St. John's Hospital talking to Johnny Howe. John, a lot of people are concerned about what happened to you. First of all, let me ask you, how you feel?
Well, in this town, we're short-winded.
In March of last year, a domestic dispute turned into a hostage taking when a young man named Dougie Thomas held his wife and her sister at gunpoint for 2 days in a neighborhood near the John Hay homes called Gregory Court. And Mbana Kantanko knew the Thomas family. He'd known Dougie Thomas since he was a child. The standoff with police began on a Friday and continued through the weekend. Kantanko broadcast updates on the incident. On Sunday, at home, Kantanko heard explosions and sirens coming from Gregory Court. He rushed to the scene.
Apparently the hostage drama in Springfield is at an end. It was a little while ago we heard some explosions. called in a prisoner transport at the command center.
What's that for, please?
There's a couple of hundred people out in the area. Mother sirens coming in the area now. Which is a police. An ambulance leaving the scene, headed westbound now, on law. I have no idea. People are breaking out now. Dougie Thomas is shot. Dougie Thomas has been shot. The reaction of the people is wild. People are running all around the area. They used a nigger cop to run everybody off so they could slip him out. John? Hey. We're following the crowd now toward the crime scene. We got a police take on.
Look, look!
We have a full-fledged riot going on here now. Police are jumping on people. The Thomas family's highly upset. Got lots of commotion going on out here. It's been said that Dougie Thomas was in the ambulance. People are crying. The Thomas is a just past Jimmy. Jimmy Thomas is running past us now.
Let the baby look!
Katanko used his hearing, his instincts, and the help of friends who led him by the arm and whispered details in his ears to describe the scene at Gregory Court. He had this tape back home and on the air 15 minutes after it was recorded.
We're going to leave the crime scene here. We're going to head over to St. John's Hospital. The crowd has thinned out. The police did get brutal for about 3 or 4 minutes, pushing, shoving, arguing, yelling. You heard everything that went down. Outside here on East Laurel for Sirius 107.1 FM. It's Dwayne Reedus. Is this tragedy really over?
Katanko couldn't get into the hospital, but he did talk to a close friend of the Thomas family by phone, on the air, as the family sat in a waiting room, watched by a patrolman.
It's just terrible. They just standing there just looking like we're really gonna do something, you know? We ain't got no guns or nothing. And they just standing there watching us. You know, you can't even cry in peace. Then you know what, Wayne? We'll never know the truth now.
No, because he's gone. He's gone.
That's so, right. You know, the family's going to turn around like they want to, you know, and the police is going to say what they want to.
Mm-hmm.
And then, when, you know, they took Dougie, they didn't even tell the mother that he was in there. They could have called off to the side, you know, that her son had been shot and picked her up and took her.
Hell yeah, they should have.
Black people don't have no feelings.
No.
You know?
No,
and
no.
We don't have no rights either.
No, we just animals, baby.
I know.
We just animals.
It is wrong.
Yeah. Well, you gonna
stay? They wonder why we act like we do. Yeah. They treat us like that. And when we do act like we got some sense, we still don't get treated like we have sense.
Are you going to stay at the hospital for a while?
I don't know. I'm going to check on my children. Because something like this.
How's your mom?
You don't wonder about your kids. You know,
yeah.
You want to go and give them a kiss and tell them I love them.
I think Dwayne Reedus means well in his own mind. I think what he's doing, he believes is right for the community.
This is Officer David Hipke of the Springfield Police. He spent 14 years on the force, most of it patrolling on the east side. Police authorities in Springfield won't talk about Mbana Katanko or his station, and won't let police officers speak to reporters without permission. Officer Hipke was given permission to speak to me about Katanko.
He makes some good, valid points, and then again, some of his positions may not be valid.
What do you think are the valid ones?
No.
Okay. What are the ones you don't like?
I know he's made the comment that on some drug raids that our people were like the South African police, you know, paramilitary ninja death squads, he called us. And that's not my perception of what's going on at all. It's a matter of enforcing the law and busting the drug dealers and this sort of thing. That's our job. to my knowledge, there's been no substantiated complaints of brutality in that neighborhood in quite some time.
Have you ever actually listened to his program?
Yes.
How'd you feel?
Well, I enjoyed some of the music. I didn't get mad or anything. You know, everyone's entitled to an opinion. If that's his opinion, then that's fine.
How's it feel to be called a pig?
Doesn't bother me.
Really?
After 14 years on the police department, I've been called a lot worse.
Now, since we've been listening to this phone call that we did with Brother Will earlier today, there were some pigs on the scanner, okay, that were doing what they normally do, you know, acting like pigs. Okay, you swine, I'm going to give you the air here again. We're going to call it swine time, okay? We're going to call it swine time. Come on. Okay, come on, you pigs. You're on the air. You hear? They're acting like they don't even hear us. And you hear us. That's why you were making those little silly sounds while we were there. There you go. There we got a pig. We got one. Hey, Stevie, why you keep riding through my alley, man? Huh?
It's my job.
Not in my alley, pal.
To protect and serve.
Protect and serve who, Stevie? Well, I tell you what, buddy. Once you get above the level of a cave dweller, black folks might have time for you. Maybe. I doubt it.
Last spring, shortly after the Gregory Court incident, police and Springfield Housing Authority officials complained to the Regional Office of the Federal Communications Commission in Chicago about Kontanko's radio station. They reported that he was broadcasting illegally and using obscene language. A few weeks later, an FCC official came calling. Kontanko, of course, had his tape recorder going.
Let me show you my identification here. Name Will Gray. I'm with the Federal Communications Commission. I want to see exactly what authority you are broadcasting under.
There ain't no authority.
What? Okay, in other words, you are operating illegally, and you know it.
What's illegal?
That you cannot broadcast.
The FCC ordered Kontanko to shut down his station. After 2 weeks off the air, he held a press conference to announce that he would defy the government and turned his transmitter back on again. With that, Kontanko began to attract the attention of the national media. Reporters and camera crews became a regular sight in the projects. Kontanko made a home videotape showing how to wire up a tiny station and find an empty frequency. So far, he's received requests for copies from 30 states and 3 foreign countries. Kontanko has encouraged all the publicity. He likes it. His supporters say it's also a good shield against the government. Any move now to shut down his station would get national coverage and make officials look bad. The FCC has fined him $750. He refuses to pay it. The FCC could eventually seize the equipment, but must act through the U.S. Attorney's Office in Springfield. The prosecutor there says he's got hundreds of other cases which are more pressing. As the night wears on, it's past 2 a.m. The fate of Zoom Black Magic Radio seems to hinge not on the government, but on whether Mbana Kontanko's old, overworked, low-budget equipment will hold up.
Okay, now we got that. Now it's back doing the same thing.
Nearby, Brenda Kontanko slouches half asleep in a faded blue chair. The speakers are turned down low so as not to wake the kids asleep upstairs. A fan near the door blows cool air into the room. The streets outside are quiet. Do you worry about what's going to happen to your kids growing up here?
Well, yeah, that's why I'm doing this. That's why I'm doing this. You know, that's exactly why I'm doing this. I got kids. If I don't do anything like this, the thing I should do if I'm a humane man is shoot him in the head and bury him in the yard. Because if somebody don't take a stand, you know, they're going to just live a hell of a tortured life, you know, and that's not the kind of life you want for your children. That's not the kind of life I want for my kids. You know, I think my kids are just as good as anybody else's kids, and they shouldn't have to be going through this stuff, you know?
At 2:40, Kentucky says goodnight, but doesn't sign off. He puts a cassette of the first 2 hours of this night's program into an auto reverse deck and hits the play button. He and Brenda go to sleep. Zoom Black Magic Radio will repeat until the morning, until someone in the family wakes up, wanders into the living room, and turns the transmitter off for a while. This is Gary Covino reporting.
The Bomb Twins first aired Thursday, September 13th at 8 o'clock p.m. Your host will be Runaway Slave in Banner, Kentucky. And for this evening, that's All Things Considered.
Okay, any reactions to that? No? Maybe?
I was in Detroit yesterday. And I hear that all the time going on. And I just finished going to school right in the middle of a black district in Detroit. And I have to say that I found myself being rather defensive of some of the things that he said. Because I don't think that all that is exactly true. He's looking at it from his perspective and not from the other side. And I'm not saying that the police, you know, that they will come out of Hampton in California. I'm not saying that we treat the black people fairly or squarely or this sort of thing, but I think that a lot of black people could help themselves a lot more than they do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did other people feel similar responses to that?
I was in the hospital situation where they talked about just the young fellow that was hostage-taker, and I had this idea in my mind that it would have been entirely different if they hadn't done anything, and he was killed when he went to the hospital, and then it would have been the opposite scenario of see where are they when we need them.
Uh-huh.
I was wrong and comfortable with the one side of the room.
Uh-huh. Okay, so both of you, different parts of the program, but both of you feel like there was a one-sidedness about that. Yeah.
Although it's rare, we still hear a lot of black anger and choose to protect the rights of blacks that they show white and call them identity.
Uh-huh.
We see fully intolerance to the group.
Uh-huh. Okay, so there's sort of a special treatment, okay, for blacks.
I thought it was interesting that the policeman said, well, he does some good things and some bad things, but couldn't think of a good thing.
Uh-huh.
I figured he was the guy that was picked because they figured he'd be favorite politics.
Yeah,
you know, yeah. But yeah, he was cheerful. He was pretty good because
right.
He's careful not to really say one thing.
I guess I felt like,
I felt like it's a balance, that it's a plenum, but it's like, a balancing point to a lot of things that are already on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of right-wing radio, there's a lot of evangelical Christian radio, there's a lot of extreme radio from other points of view. And so I guess I think people who are oppressed sometimes are pushed to violence because of the lack of their voice.
Mm-hmm.
Christian. We have a space, and I don't think
that people are in society. Now, I know there's instances, people have said, with Los Angeles, older people saying, come out on the street, and that helped build the rise. Well, maybe that's true, I don't know. But I think sometimes people are driven to violence by having no means of expression, hearing any voice like this. My thought was, why not get a license? Why make that the confrontational part of it?
Chaos is the word.
If you tell me how to convince they're wrong, well, that's obviously much more extreme.
Uh-huh.
But if you have a lot of illegal broadcast stations now all over the country, you have an unintelligible radio reception in many areas.
Okay.
Couldn't there be a kind of a piece in that FCC licensing procedure that allows a small radius type radio like that?
Uh-huh.
To operate under a licensing.
There is. And
but it's still 100,000?
No, you can do it. We had one in college, it was similar, although it was black. Mm-hmm. And it is possible. He's a little over the limit, not a whole lot. He's about four times the limit, which isn't too far over.
Okay, that's a real interesting point that you make. Which is to envision what it would be like if there were lots of people doing low power radio. Your argument is exactly the argument that was originally used when both in terms of setting up the FCC, but also in terms of the FRC, when it was started, the Federal Radio Commission, before it became the Federal Communications Commission, and has been used to justify that ever since. We don't have this much space, and so it has to be allocated. Who do we allocate it to? Well, we allocate it in the public interest. Who is in the public interest? Well, of course, business is in the public interest. And we're going to give a little narrow part of that band up the front end. If you go all the way to the left side of your dial, you get your religious stations and NPR. And that part of the band is for public or nonprofit or religious or other groups. And then that breaks off. And it's just a little narrow part, and the rest of it is commercial. But I think it's a if we go back, let's just go back historically a little bit. What happened when radio was invented was that that a lot of people were real interested in it, and it's cheap. I mean, you know, like you said, $600, maybe less, you could put together something that could broadcast. I mean, you could probably do it far less than that. You went to Radio Shack. It wouldn't take much at all to broadcast a signal that would be receivable, and that's what ham operators did. Ham operators still do that on a different part of the spectrum. But everybody, you know, all these people who were really amateurs and were interested in radio, you know, set up a little station in their garage and started broadcasting. And what happened was the larger broadcasters got very upset at this because these little stations were disrupting their signal. If it disrupted their signal, it's disrupting their dependability. It's disrupting their profits in terms of being able to sell time to people. Because people who buy advertising time want to make sure that that message actually gets out to this many people at this particular time. So they, you know, there were several conferences in the 20s in Washington where Herbert Hoover, before he became president, tried to sort this out. And of course, the people who were invited to the conference were NBC and all the big Westinghouse, all the big companies. And they divided up the spectrum to suit them and left a little left over for the public, and said, okay, now we've got a good radio system. And I think it would be interesting to speculate what it would be like if we did have more chaos. That is, what if there were in every community, you know, whoever was interested in putting a program on the air could do it. You would have some overlapping signals, probably. You would have disruption of commercial radio as we know it. But we would have something that we don't have now, which is access. We would be able to find a way to broadcast, to throw out our ideas. Okay? And that's something that's denied not just to blacks, but it's denied to almost all of us. Now, the only access we can get is we can call in a talk radio program, and hopefully if we wait on the line long enough, can get on and talk until the guy cuts us off. And even that is a remarkable breakthrough, something that really wasn't there 10 years ago and is now fairly common. And I think the popularity of talk radio is, in some sense, a response to this lack of access, that people feel they need to hear other voices than the mainstream voice. And one of the other things that you mentioned at the beginning was how... what was your point? Say it again. What did you say? It's one-sidedness. Somebody mentioned something else. And what was it? Just flew out of my mind. In the mainstream media. Oh, it was your comment, the first one, right? That certain things were on there. We're hearing certain things that we wouldn't otherwise. Oh no. Who was it that said about hate? That so you said it's okay to hate, to say nasty things about blacks, but it's not. About whites, but not about blacks.
Is that black rights to
exactly
hate language towards whites?
Right, right. And part of that is a notion of what is currently. Within the public sphere, whatever is proper at the current moment. It's sort of like politically correctness. But, for example, the word nigger would never be used by a broadcaster. Okay, he just would not, if Koppel went on and said, well, you know, the niggers in L.A., rioted again. Well, people would be outraged, you know. He has to say, and he can't even say the Negroes. He has to say the blacks, okay? And that language is universal throughout the media. We've accepted that blacks is the term that will be used. Okay, and this seems to be very sensitive to the blacks who originally said we want to be called blacks, not Negroes. But what actually happens is this mainstream allows only certain kinds of ways of addressing problems. That if you don't address it this way, it won't work. Now, you're right to some extent that it is permissible within mainstream media to hear the voices of angry blacks and less so to hear the voices of Ku Klux Klan people, although occasionally we hear them too. We see pictures of people saying, do this, do that, right? Oh, sure we do. We see Ku Klux. Don't we see pictures of Ku Klux Klan rallies or, you know, whatever, the abortion issue or whatever. The media itself is careful not to take a position or to take what it views as an even-handed position. A little of this balanced against a little of that. And it's very interesting if you see a documentary or if you see a public affairs show, we always have to have this balance, you know, so we have a Republican here, and then we have a Democrat here. Okay, we have a conservative, a liberal. We have a pro-abortion, anti-abortion. Okay, in every program, we have to have this. What we can't have is a program in which, which is made by say, a pro-abortion or anti-abortion or whatever, pro-life, anti-life, whatever, however you want to call it, we can't have a program made by just one side on the mainstream media, because that wouldn't be balanced, okay? It wouldn't be, and as a result, because everything seems to be balanced, we never really get to hear an authentic voice speaking its piece. And we also tend to get this balance in a fairly narrow spectrum. So we don't really hear an articulate, say, socialist or communist having his chance to say more than, you know, 5 minutes on Ted Koppel. We don't get, say, Michael Harrington, rest in peace, we didn't get Michael Harrington with an hour show in which he gets to control. So we might get a show in which he becomes an object who we talk about and who gets, you know, his little clip. But he doesn't have his own show. Yeah, what are you going to say?
I hear you saying that we're getting a narrow view and excluding access to alternative views.
Mm-hmm.
And I would agree with most of that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you're confusing supply and demand. You're using conspiratorial kind of plots here about General Electric and Warner and Time dividing up the radio spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there may be some truth to that, but more often it is the media mogul trying to find a programmer who can put together a program which gets enough audience share, that the ratings go up, that the advertisers support the station. And so reality is that decisions are made not by the programmers, they're made by the consumer. And if people don't turn to those stations,
right.
Most stations don't continue because they can't support themselves.
Exactly.
It's a demand issue. It is us, not them. It's not the programmers in New York making our decisions to us. It's us turning our dial on and failing to listen to the socialists. Because of the socialists.
Okay, that's an interesting point. That's an interesting point. And it's the point that the television networks always say. That is, we give the customers what they want. Okay? Now the problem with that argument is that, again, we're talking about a profit-driven media system, okay? And we're talking about a system that is not interested in making a little profit. We're talking about a system that's interested in maximizing profits, okay? How do you maximize profits? You maximize audience. So the important thing, of course, is not to appeal to put on programming that's going to be of interest to 50 people in Springfield, Illinois. Okay? It's to be something that's of interest to affluent white consumers. Okay? We don't care about the blacks because they don't have any purchasing power. And if they do have purchasing power, then we're going to start to care about them. But what we're interested in is a certain set of demographics, and to maximize the number of people in those demographics who listen, which then means that we narrow the spectrum, because these socialists aren't going to be worth, there aren't going to be enough of them, or they're not worth selling. Okay? Now the point is then that becomes kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. That is, if we never listen to what Michael Harrington has to say about what's wrong with the society, because they think not enough people are interested in listening to it, and we do know that people are interested in watching Westerns, and we just keep running Westerns over and over again, we never hear the Michael Harrington's talk. Okay? And if we had a system in which, say, it was important to hear something that only 2% or 1% or 0.5% of the population wanted to hear, but that other people could catch in passing or by accident or out of boredom or by channel zapping, you might up that number of people who are interested in that programming to 1% or maybe 2% even. But that won't happen if we're always trying to maximize the audience. And that's my point. The conspiracy theory is not that simple. It's not because guys in New York are sitting around and saying, you know, we don't want this on the air. On the other hand, you can be sure that the nightly news is affected by corporate concerns. Which gets on, pressure that they get from politics in terms of how they cover things, pressures from all kinds of things internally. I mean, you talk to any journalist, they'll say, sure, I've had stories censored, stories you know, thrown out that were too sensitive to the bosses. I can't, if I'm working for Time Magazine, I'm not going to be able to do an investigative piece on Warner Brothers Pictures. Everybody knows that. So there is some direct kind of censorship. But I think you're right that what's more important is that the profit motive is an important filter on what gets through to us from that world. And again, media, we talked about the other day, a medium is something that's between us and reality. It's something that's sifting through reality and saying, this is worth our attention, this is interesting, this is important, and this is not, you know. And there are other considerations too. I mean, in the nightly news, you know, if you watch locally, you don't have extensive coverage of, say, sort of complex legislative bills. What you have is reports on fires because they're more visual. And they found that people like to, you know, TV's a visual medium, so we should show visual things. So there are other filters as well besides that. What I'm arguing here, though, is that what we just heard is a very unusual kind of thing in American broadcasting. And for that community in which this takes place, even while it may have some negative things in terms of, oh, maybe it fosters anti-police feeling, maybe it increases tensions, maybe it does all kinds of things, but what it is doing is giving those people a voice. And they might not agree with them at all times either. I mean, they might very well say, you know, I think your coverage is too, you know, whatever. And he's got to deal with that in a way that's probably more significant than the way a crank letter would be to NBC. Because these are people he lives with and works with on a daily basis. So in some ways, it's going to be more responsive to that community. But one of the things that I wanted us to think about is, to what extent do we have control? To what extent do we get a voice? And to what extent do we hear other voices in our media? Okay? Now, some of the voices that we hear we're going to disagree with, some of the voices we're not going to like, but I would argue it would be much better for us to hear what the Ku Klux Klan is thinking than to pretend that the Ku Klux Klan doesn't exist and isn't a powerful force in American society. Now, clearly by giving it more coverage, there may be more recruits for the Ku Klux Klan. My argument would be, and it's the argument that the ACLU is not to restrain speech, but the answer to bad speech is more speech. That is, you put something out there, it's bad, you talk about why it's bad, okay? And to have more of this kind of dialogue. So to that extent, I see this talk radio, despite the fact that a lot of these guys are right-wing loonies, as useful because it at least is getting people talking and thinking about things and active in them. Yeah.
Now the parallel for the radio is the limited access TV and the Ku Klux Klan and some areas beyond that. I'm talking about there not being voice for anti-black. I think in some communities the Ku Klux Klan has gotten access to the free
cable channels.
And there's been a lot of people who've gotten real upset about it. I think the ACLU has really come on their side saying they have the right to do that.
Yeah, what do you say?
You notice the discussions about broadcast media.
Uh-huh.
You don't hear these kinds of discussions about print media. No one seems to be saying that blacks have no access to the printing press, and that the press is unfairly censored and one-sided. You can read it, put out a call here and read just about anything you want to read.
Mm-hmm.
All right? It's a technological problem. really, when it gets down to it, why is there a difference? There's only one difference. Because you can print and circulate as many possible circulars and newspapers and periodicals as you want. There's no limit.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, our technology has limited the number of television channels and radio frequencies. It's just a technological problem.
Mm-hmm.
We're getting beyond that now. You alluded to it.
Mm-hmm.
We now have cable. We can all get 103 channels in our home, and I understand with the fiber optics, we're all going to be wired for the next 15 years or so. You're going to have virtually unlimited access within your own home. Maybe that will fix a lot of it. It won't fix the human heart.
Right.
But it will certainly eliminate the argument that the broadcast media is limited to access to minority groups.
Yeah, it may. What I would say is two things. One is that when cable was first licensed, franchises were set up. Typically, these were controlled by local governments, and one of the requirements a lot of local governments put on was to have local access. And almost all of those have been, well, not all of them, but a lot of them have been dropped, and those aren't true for new licensing things. So you can have 30 channels, you can have 150 channels, but if there's no access for you to put things on, or we're in a situation in Boise where we can put programs on the air, but they can all be censored. So if there's something that's, for example, in one student video, they did an imitation of Madonna, and one of the women grabbed her crotch, cut the whole video. Another one, Santa Claus is reading Dr. Seuss while sitting on the toilet. He doesn't have his pants off or anything, but we don't want to show a toilet. Okay. Or in another one, you might be critical of somebody, the mayor of the city. Well, we don't want to make the mayor mad. So they can censor anything they want. And that's, the question is, will there be access to people? We can have 200 channels as long as it's, old movies that's the same thing over and over again. It won't make any difference. The question is, who gets to put the programming on? And I agree with you that part of the problem has been technological limitations, but I would also say let's look at how that pie was divided up and who got pieces of that pie. And what I would argue is there are some big pieces of pie rather than a lot of little pieces of pie, which is a different way it could have been allocated.
I think this argument is going to largely fail to exist in this.
It may, but the other problem is that it's a highly technological medium, and that is, you and I may have camcorders, but what can we do beyond that? Now, the print journalism thing is another interesting question. We can all print, but again, how do we distribute? And that becomes very, very expensive. And again, while there's thousands and thousands of publications, even in print, something like half of them are going to be run by the top 15 corporations in America. So when every local newspaper, or lots of local newspapers are owned by Gannett, how much diversity of opinion are you going to have? You're going to have happy news in every community. Okay, we've run, we're just about on time. This raises a lot of questions, but what I wanted to do is to say, okay, there are alternative models and there are other ways we could think about it. And one other point I would just make is some countries like Germany and England and other places feel you don't need balance necessarily within programs, but what would be more interesting is to have a balance throughout all of your programming so that you would have one show by this person and another show by a communist and another show by the whatever. And instead of balancing it and coming up with some kind of, kind of compromise, middle-of-the-road thing where you're left saying, which I think so often happens in these, you sort of throw up your hands and say, well, there's an expert on this side, an expert on this side, what do I do? That you could actually have somebody articulately making a complete case rather than being cut off by Ted because we're out, we have to go to a commercial. Okay, we have to go to a commercial now, so. But anyway, I hope this was stimulating in a certain way. Oh, one other comment that I just would like to make just to close. Right before I started this, Berlon was here, and we talked a little bit about what it meant to be a black here in Holden. And he was saying that being a black, he regards being here in some ways as being in a foreign country. And he said that that's an exaggerated position of what most black Americans feel all the time. That is that they have no country of their own and they're here in a place that doesn't belong to them. And so anything like this where they can feel they have some control and some over their lives becomes a very important thing, which I think it's very hard for us as whites to understand. Why is there that depth of resistance? And anyway, okay.
Thank you for coming.